You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, it's been a month since President Trump declared COVID-19 a national emergency. Since then, many people and families have been staying at home in an effort to slow the spread of the virus. We'll talk to a public health expert about how successful those initiatives have been and what the long-term goal could be. First, if there's one good thing about safe-at-home orders happening during the spring, it's that it's giving people a lot more time to work on their gardens. For many people, gardening isn't just to dress up our homes or to supply us with fresh veggies during the summer. It can also be therapeutic. Maybe feeling the dirt between our fingers literally puts us in touch with nature. Maybe we like watching stuff grow and feeling a sense of accomplishment. Nothing else, it's something that takes your mind off of things. Whatever the case, there's actually a professional practice known as horticultural therapy. It's designed to improve physical and mental health, and our guest is quite involved in that concept. Mike Maddox is director of the UW-Madison Master Gardener Program and is horticultural therapist registered. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, happy to be here.
Well, Mike, I know a lot of people feel like gardening, getting their hands dirty, feels good, but it's actually therapeutic. Can you talk about some of the benefits?
Well, yeah, it can be therapeutic. And any gardener who's turned in or who's tuned into this program knows this. Gardening can be people's individual therapy. Interacting with plants has a positive benefit on our minds and bodies. And what's been really cool in the 20 years of me being involved in horticulture and horticulture education is the research that has gone into this has really grown. And it really helps us to document it and to explain it to folks like today on what is the medical benefits, the health benefits of getting people outside interacting with plants.
Interesting. What kind of benefits does the research point toward?
Well, we know that just by looking at plants, but better yet, interacting with plants, that we can decrease stress. You can decrease your anxiety. You can decrease your depression. It helps with your blood pressure. And right now, as I'm like been at the computer all day for 4 weeks now, I know going outside and interacting with plants helps with mental restoration, allows me to focus, better to concentrate, better. It's just all around with your mind and body. Just looking at plants, but better yet, interacting with plants can improve just your overall well-being, however you define that.
Now, Mike, some people have, you know, a big garden. Some people have a modest garden. Some people in apartments might not have that kind of opportunity, though. Can we get these benefits just from, you know, working with some maybe potted plants out on a, I don't know, a balcony or a terrace or something like that?
Yeah. When I started studying horticultural therapy, I remember somebody saying it would be ideal if we could all be in those gardens just to immerse ourselves and surround ourselves with plants. But you don't have to do that. I mean, right now, my houseplants are getting really tired of me talking to them. So just having that one houseplant in the room can really help brighten your mood, give you that mental restoration. I mean, this is why bouquets of flowers can be so important, or even for at times for holidays or for grieving, you give people flowers. And what does it do? It helps improve their mood. So it doesn't need to be a big garden. It can just be that pothos you have in the window. It could be a bouquet you pick up on sale when you're making a run to the grocery store. But better yet, going outside. Ultimately, what you want to do is have something that gives you that sensory stimulation, something you can touch, that you can smell, you know, potentially taste, that you just something to interact with. That's what's critical.
Mike Maddox is with us, director of the UW-Madison Master Gardener Program. He is horticultural therapist registered. We're talking about the benefits of gardening, big or small, getting our hands dirty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If this is something that you feel like is good for you, if you're out there over the last week, if you're looking forward to getting some serious work, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Mike, I was poking around online some. It looks like if you're a gardener and you need to buy some stuff, it is out there. A lot of stores are doing curbside pickup or have special arrangements, maybe phoning first. But I think that gardening and food growing and things like that is considered essential. So we're not shut down right now if we want to get out gardening. Is that what you're seeing?
I'm seeing a lot of different things going on right now, and I'm not fully aware how all this fits under the safer at home order. Sure. I know I have picked up a few things when I have ran for my essential items, like to the grocery store. I know I picked up some seeds just for some diversionary activities over the weekend. You know, the hardware store, I had to make a repair on some plumbing. So while I was there, I picked up some dirt in order to plant those seeds. So I know that there are plants available. I know I'm not able to do my normal garden shopping as I would have in years past, but you know, within the scope of the order and doing those essential runs, you can find some things out there. It's not going to be the gardening that I've done in the past, but it's getting me through right now.
Yeah, again, just in my informal online survey, I would strongly encourage people to call or go online first to see what your local supplier of garden supplies is doing. A little forethought is probably the way to go. So, Mike, this is a uniquely weird time right now, in part because of what we were just talking about there. Is this an especially good time to get our hands dirty?
Well, I'm always going to advocate for gardening no matter when. That's my job. I just hope that when people do get into it, and a lot of people are really going for all our educational programs that are going on out there. I've got colleagues who've been doing some online training with seed starting. I think what's really important is that for people just to try. I find that gardening can sometimes be complicated by some gardening professionals. And I really just want to advocate, get some seeds, throw it in the ground, see what grows, celebrate the success that you have. And then what you learn from that experience, then, you know, help grow yourself as a gardener. I don't think gardening needs to be super complicated for anybody who's looking to get involved. You know, pick up some radish seeds from the grocery store, you know, get some potting mix and just see what grows. Get some cat grass, grow some oats. You know, just have that experience. It doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need to be digging up turf in your yard right now if you don't want to go there, but just do something. And it doesn't need to be perfect. Just interact with plants right now.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was going to ask your guest today. I love to do some of the planting around the houses and some of our landscaping. And what I find really enjoyable, and it seems to take a lot of stress out, is when I've taken one of those plant trees or shrubs or plants that are the half-priced ones, the ones that don't look as good, and kind of make them into something that starts to thrive after a couple of years. Is there anything that improves? Is there anything that of your research that shows that kind of that you feel better about a plant and it's actually more therapeutic if that plant is sicker or not as good, and then you get it to come back and be a thriving tree or bush?
I love it. Rescue trees and shrubs, Mike.
You know, I have to say, in my own garden, I have those connections with plants that I've pulled off a compost pile and have nursed back to health. That's given me that feeling of, you know, personal satisfaction, that ability to nurture something. For the hort therapy point of view, I have found that kind of process to be really useful. Like back in the day when I was working with incarcerated folks, to give them that ability to feel nurturing and to feel that sense of accomplishment that I was able to do something, in this case, using a plant as that vehicle in order to get that feeling and that change in well-being. So, yeah, I don't think there's actually research to show, you know, to have that plant be sick and make it better what it does. But just knowing that you were able to do it, or even just, you know, that satisfaction of, wow, I found a really good deal on this plant, I'm going to make it work, put it in my garden and see how it grows. It's that this is where it crosses into that. How does it make you feel? And if it's making you feel better, that's what's important.
Thanks a lot for the call, Charlie. We're talking about the therapeutic benefits of gardening. Mike Maddox is with us, director of the UW-Madison Master Gardener Program and horticulture therapist registered himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you're a master gardener or if you're like me, I guess the opposite of a master gardener, we'd love to hear from you. Do you feel that kind of benefit when you work with anything from a big chunk of yard and garden to a smaller potted plant? Does it make you feel more at ease, maybe especially in a time of high anxiety? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you been out doing some work, even though there's some snow outside the window right now? Have you already been working on your garden, or do you have plans afoot? 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about gardening as a therapeutic escape from the coronavirus. Mike Maddox is with us, director of the UW-Madison Master Gardener Program. Mike is horticultural therapist registered. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been doing some gardening this spring already? Maybe as a result of the coronavirus, now or anytime, do you find working in the yard, the garden, on the potted plants, the herb garden in your windowsill, whatever, do you find it relaxing, stress-reducing yourself? Call in, tell us your gardening story. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Sherry is with us in Janesville. Sherry, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Sherry?
I was just wondering, this is Sherry from Janesville, from Rotary. Hi, Mike. Nice to see you and hear you and all that good stuff. a question about stuck in the house with kids and other relatives or people that you are in the house with. What to do? Easy things to do gardening-wise or such?
Well, if you've got the access to the materials, just do some simple seed starting. Maybe get some marigold seeds to get them planted. In this case, I would actually maybe structure it so it's a way that you would all be gathered around the table together and use it as an opportunity to have a conversation about maybe what's going on, or better yet, a conversation about what's not going on. Use it as a kind of a positive diversionary activity to take the family's mind off doing this activity. Maybe pick up some flowers that may be on sale and do some flower arranging in the house and give people a chance to express themselves and interact with the plant material while they are making their own personal arrangements. You know, maybe you pick up those flowers on sale and you do a flower pounding exercise, which, you know, this is destroying the plants, but you're still getting people to interact with them by putting the flowers on paper, putting a piece of cellophane over them, and then smacking them with a hammer. That's physical exercise. You're interacting with plant material. It's fun. It's different. And it's artistic expression. Ultimately, what I want to see people do is interact with plants. Take cuttings off an overgrown houseplant, put them in water, watch the roots happen. I don't think it needs to be super complicated. Just get people to interact with plants.
Sherry, thanks for the call. Great question. Back to your calls now. Tasha is with us in Minocqua. Tasha, hello.
Hi, can you guys hear me okay?
Sure can. Go for it, Tasha.
Okay, cool. Thank you for taking my call. So I got divorced last May. And I went immediately from the courthouse to Walmart. I picked up a basil, a cherry tomato, and a strawberry. And from there, it blossomed into a whole patio garden. And it completely changed my life. Like, I never felt better than when I did my garden. I went to houseplants over the winter. And I cannot even explain how improved my mental health got from gardening.
Wow. Yep. Well, I got to ask you before you go, Tasha, do you have big plans this year?
I do. I've spent about $100 on seeds already. I'm getting ready to start them this weekend. I am so ready.
Fantastic, Tasha. Thanks a lot. Mike, what do you think?
I think that is a wonderful way to celebrate a life transition. Pick up something, turn over a new leaf, get a new constructive hobby. I think that's awesome.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Tasha. Ryan joins us now in Madison. Ryan, hello.
Hey, good day. Bill Pelletieri's nephew-in-law here. Because of the 40-some houseplants I've had for over 20 years, I decided 4 years ago to grow my own vegetables from seed, because for 12 years I've been helping with the family garden that I inherited responsibility of. So I have 150 cabbage already. I've transitioned to outdoor containers, getting ready to put them in the ground. At night I have to put them in the garage, but they're getting full sun. I have over 100 tomato, over 100 pepper, and already now that I have half of them, I have, well, put into the next size of cup. I just bought another grow light, so I have four shop lights. So the fourth year I've had this one on, and I have 400 onions in the ground already. that the squirrels have been messing with because of them having buried the black walnuts in the nice soft dirt. I have 5 raised bed gardens that I made from the lumber left over from when I did my own roof 6 years ago.
Wow.
And I also have 20 of those tomatoes in buckets at my house and another 12 peppers in buckets. And I kept the peppers in the house 3 winters in a row because you probably know they're trees. But I did this the first year I didn't try to overwinter my pepper trees.
Wow. Ryan, I got to ask before we let you go, what are you doing with all those cabbages?
What do you think? All summer long, I lost weight by not eating carbs, but peppers, onions, tomatoes, cabbage, and meat. I still have plenty of deer left and 5 gallons of black raspberries from the backyard. And down the street, I have about 3 gallons left of those black raspberries, 12 jars of tomatoes,
wow,
12 jars of canned venison.
All right, Ryan, thanks a lot. So, Mike, Ryan's doing this on a larger scale than I probably ever will, but you could actually feed yourself pretty good if you put your mind to it.
Oh, you could. And think of all the health benefits that come from eating vegetables and just how much more satisfaction you have in eating those when you've grown those yourself. I mean, when you hear his enthusiasm, he talks about it, his positive feelings towards the success he's had. Think about all that physical work of moving these plants around and building those beds and tending to all. There's a lot of benefits that come with it. You know, sometimes it's sweat equity you're putting into it, but he's benefiting from it. He's feeling pride in his work. That's that great thing about therapeutic horticulture and just that benefit you get from plants. You know, he's proud in it. He's self-sufficient and he's doing something.
He's well fed. Yeah. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about the therapeutic benefits of gardening with Mike Maddox, director of the UW-Madison Master Gardener Program, a horticultural therapist, a registered gardener himself. Hey, we had a question from Ben in New Richland. Ben is a first-time gardener. He's interested in getting some of these therapeutic effects. He wants some suggestions about where to actually begin. What would you tell him, Mike?
Information. Find that information out there. I would want to plug our horticulture page on Facebook, our horticulture program on Facebook. I know we've been really active in getting information on there, especially for first-time gardeners, just to learn. But Ben, I think what I have to tell you is just try it. Don't overthink it. Throw some seeds in the ground, buy a plant. I was just editing a video from a colleague and friend today where she said, failure is our tool for learning. They're just plants. You know, you'll get more seeds. Just try something, have fun with it, experiment. If it works, celebrate it. If it doesn't work, learn from it. Try it again and see what happens.
What I love about this, Mike, is that you could put a lot of money into your garden, but you could get a pretty good first-time experiment for, you know, $10-$20 worth of seeds.
I think that would be a lot of seeds, depending on what you want to buy. I mean, I think there are some really easy, friendly seeds to get started to really boost your success. You know, get some radish seeds and throw those in the ground. Get some green beans. Wait till it warms up. Throw those in the ground. Spinach, marigolds. It doesn't need to be a lot of money just to get you started. That will come later. I don't want to think about how much money I paid. That just makes me depressed from all the years of gardening. But it's those simple successes that I find really satisfying. It's that plant that I got on discount. It's the seeds that somebody gave me that I didn't even know what they were, and I wound up loving a new plant. It's this old container that used to be my grandmother's that I make a point of planting something in every year. It's gardening can be so many things. It doesn't always need to be these really big, fancy bouquets of flowers that sometimes that's what media is selling you that gardening needs to be. It doesn't always need to be that perfect green lawn. You know, I like to think of it's more of that process. And what are you getting out of it personally?
I want to ask you, Mike, you know, we have a lot of opportunities for instant gratification. You want to stream a movie, you can have it right now. You can buy a thing with one click. Gardening works at its own speed. It's deferred gratification. Is that part of the satisfaction, do you think?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that a lot of first-time gardeners need to learn, that it does have that delayed gratification that comes. It's not instant. It's what I Ben Fuda from Allen Centennial Garden refers to it as one of the slowest form of the performing arts or something like that. It's a really great quote. It's not instant. It takes time. It teaches you patience. It teaches you persistence. And, you know, people who want instant gratification may not initially take to gardening, but I know through my work with folks over the years and first-time gardeners or people who've just been really resistant to gardening, once you get them through the first couple weeks of interacting with plants and they've planted those seeds literally and figuratively, and they start to see the process grow, that's when you start getting people interested. I'm reflecting back on my days working with jail inmates, and people would come back and be like, I don't want to do this. You know, they've got their machismo. They don't want to participate. But after a couple weeks, they're talking about what their future wants to be. They start reminiscing about their time gardening with their grandmothers and grandparents. And we're gardening through this entire time, but we're using it as an opportunity to reflect on how they feel and what their aspirations want to be, and hopefully give them some success, and better yet, give them a positive diversionary activity, you know, that they can do later.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for the encouragement, and thanks for joining us today.
You are welcome. Thank you for having me.
Mike Maddox is the director of the UW-Madison Master Gardener Program and is horticultural therapist registered. We talked to him about the therapeutic benefits of gardening during the coronavirus pandemic. His lesson for non-gardeners or bad gardeners like me, just get out and do it. You're going to feel pretty good about it. Something else you might feel pretty good about, giving to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm guessing WPR is a big part of your day, your go-to for essential news, in-depth analysis of important issues, great entertainment, and maybe some day-to-day inspiration. Listeners like you are the biggest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. We are in our spring member drive. Your gift right now supports Central Time and all the other Ideas Network programs you rely on. Give now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. You can also make that gift online. It takes just a few minutes at WPR.org. Thank you so much for your support now, in the past, and hopefully in the future. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent talks to the leaders of two key state agencies about the latest efforts to deal with the impact of COVID-19. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it's been more than a month since the World Health Organization declared the ongoing novel coronavirus outbreak a pandemic, and yesterday marked 1 month since President Trump declared COVID-19 a national emergency. Over that month, many states, including Wisconsin, issued guidelines for residents that required individuals and families to stay at home as much as possible, and people have been advised to maintain a significant amount of distance between themselves and others. There have been some exceptions to those rules for essential workers, for people to run errands, and over the month, some guidance has changed, including the CDC asking people now to wear masks when they do need to go out in public. Our next guest joins us to talk about how to evaluate these initiatives, how successful they've been, and what we should be looking for in the days to come. Patrick Remington is a professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back, Rob. Thanks.
Well, something that seems to keep coming up, and let me know if you're seeing this in the news reports, when we're looking at countries, when we're looking at states, about 2 weeks after more stringent stay-at-home measures come into place, it seems like the curve gets flattened some. The expansion of cases seems to be going down. Is that something you're seeing?
Absolutely. Stay-at-home orders or stay safe at home absolutely work. The virus needs to go from person to person, and the less connections we have between people, the fewer opportunities we have for contagion to spread. So if everybody were to stay home, and I mean everybody, the virus might circulate within homes, but within 2 weeks it would stop circulating in a community. Obviously, we know that's not possible. There are people who get sick, and we need healthcare workers to take care of them. And we have essential services so that people can eat and go from place to place. So we need to have society having some people work and get out. But those who can afford to stay home, either working from home or not working, then they should do that.
One of the key things seems to be the ability of some people to have the virus, not have a significantly strong symptoms, but still spread it. And we've seen case studies from China and then one from the CDC looking at a person in Chicago before safer at home orders. They had traveled within the country. They came back. They went to, I think, a birthday party, a funeral, and a dinner, and had spread the illness to more than a dozen people, a few of whom later died. That is in some ways the most insidious and hard to control part of this and the hardest to wrap our heads around. What do you think?
Yes, it certainly is. This virus is unique in its ability to be contagious well before an individual gets symptomatic. And that makes the spread insidious, that people are spreading the virus when they feel well, either before they get symptoms, and some people never get symptoms. They remain asymptomatic. And those individuals, we've seen outbreak after outbreak where those individuals, by no fault of their own, they didn't know that they were contagious, have spread it to others. And it makes the control even more difficult.
One question I see coming up again and again, Dr. Remington, is how we're accounting for the death toll related to COVID-19. Concerns on one hand that we are undercounting it, that in some cases people have died of this, whether in a hospital or at home, and never been tested, and they don't get counted in the overall toll. And then some people critical of a CDC guideline that says, even if you don't have a test, but all the medical evidence suggests that this was COVID-19, you should count it. Then people are saying, hold on, you're going to overcount the illness. What do you make of that back and forth?
Well, we've known for a long time that death certificates and attributing cause of death is a difficult thing to do. We rely on the judgment of physicians or coroners to make that decision. You can't be absolutely strict and say you have to have a positive COVID test. If a clinician, in his or her opinion, thinks that this death was related to symptoms that were classic for COVID, that happened in a community, in an area with community spread, maybe even with a contact with a known case, then that's certainly reasonable to say that this is a COVID attributed death. I think those are at the margin, though. Those are not really the central numbers. Most of the numbers of deaths that we're seeing are from people who've been diagnosed, have been very, very sick, and have been in a hospital, and those are absolutely confirmed cases.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest public health-related news about COVID-19. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Remington, I wonder, looking back, it seems like a big turning point here, a thing that could have made things a lot worse, was when the NBA first said, hey, we're going to stop having games, then the NCAA championships, and then at the state level, state basketball and other championships canceled. Heartbreaking, I know, for everybody involved, but it seems like if those had happened, we might be in a much worse situation. I know it's hard to have what-if scenarios. How important were those decisions?
Well, those turned out to be incredibly important decisions. I have to be honest, back in February 7th, when you and I spoke, we had one case in the state of Wisconsin. And I, at that time, thought that we would be seeing an increase, but I didn't think we would be seeing the pandemic that we have today. I thought when I heard that the NBA had been canceled, I thought that that was perhaps too cautious. A good type of caution, but too much caution. And now looking back, it's absolutely not the case. Those decisions were hard decisions to make economically and from an entertainment perspective, but they were absolutely the right decisions. We've seen terrible outbreaks in places where people continued to gather, whether it be a funeral or a choir practice. And if we had had large gatherings like basketball games, we know we would have been seeing people not able to even get to the hospital, let alone get on a ventilator.
I want to start looking toward the future now. Hopefully someday we're going to get a vaccine and or effective treatments that improve people's chance of survival and chance of avoiding long hospitalizations. But that, if and when it's going to happen, is a long way off, and we're probably not going to have full safer at home until then. What kind of mid-level steps can you see us taking in the time between full-on safer at home and hopefully something that's going to make this less of a big deal?
Well, almost 2 months ago, we talked about the difference between the public health response, between isolation, which is what you do with an individual who's sick. You isolate them so they don't expose others. And then quarantine, which is used to put people effectively in isolation, but they don't have the illness. They have a probability of being exposed. What we've done with the stay at home or stay safer at home order is basically quarantine everybody. And that's an overreach, really. It's not very efficient. It's certainly effective because if everybody stays home, the disease will not spread. But what we need to do is use quarantine like we would for any other infectious disease. Identify people who are sick, identify their contacts, and then quarantine them. And so we really have to be smarter with quarantine. That takes a tremendous amount of work. It takes really an army of people, of public health workers, to go out and not only identify cases with better testing, but also then track down all the potential contacts. And it's going to take the public to agree to that. As we begin to go back to work, you may get a call saying that you've potentially been exposed and you need to be quarantined. And that's going to be different. Right now, basically everybody who's non-essential is quarantined, and we know that can't continue forever. We need to use smarter approaches and more targeted quarantines for those people who've been potentially exposed to a case. And I see that coming. I've talked to colleagues at the State Health Department, and they're gearing up for that. But that takes a great number of people to roll up their sleeves and get to work in the public health trenches.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us to talk about how ongoing public health initiatives, including safer at home guidelines, have helped slow the spread of COVID-19 and to look at what comes next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these public health guidelines? What do you want to see from the government, from private business, and more to do to stop the spread of COVID-19? Do you see this changing your personal behavior maybe for the long run? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You count on WPR for high-quality news, conversations, and music. During our spring member drive, we count on you, and we have you and your feet covered. Support the programs you rely on and ask for the new cozy WPR socks when you give $10 a month or more. You can get that at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Thank you for your support. Now we continue our conversation about public health initiatives and how they've impacted the spread of COVID-19. Dr. Patrick Remington stays with us from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And we'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Tripoli. Rick, hello. Rick, are you there? I don't hear Rick. Let's try Sarah then in Madison. Sarah, hello.
Hello, I'm here.
Hi, what did you want to bring up, Sarah?
Hi, I'm a hairstylist in Madison, and I haven't been working, and I'm supposed to go back to work on April 24th, which I miss working, but I also feel a little nervous because of the fact that I'm going to be around people, and then is this going to cause another surge, or do you see that the state is going to close for another month? Because the other hairstylists are also concerned about whether or not we're going to be reopening on that day.
Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Remington, I know there's a lot going into that decision of whether to extend it, but what are your thoughts on what Sarah brought up?
Well, I think we're on the cusp of seeing the pandemic, the number of new cases level off, but clearly we're not out of the woods. I think we'll have some hard decisions to make. Obviously, it's up to the leadership at the State Health Department and the governor's office. But I think we're not ready to go back to work. I think, if anything, we may see certain sectors being able to go back for those essential workers, perhaps people who have already established immunity by being ill or can demonstrate that they have immunity. But I think the general going back to work won't happen so soon. I think we've made great progress. It's been an effective response, but we need to buy more time so that we have the capacity to take care of sick people and so that we can really figure this out, not just to make it up as we go, but to learn lessons and go back to work with the resources that we need, with the public health infrastructure, so that if somebody were to get sick and before they went to the hair salon in Madison, that they would have been called, identified, and put into quarantine, so that you don't have people going around who are incubating the disease, exposing people who are back to work. And so we're not quite there. That's going to be like having an army for the census, but we need an army for people to do contact tracing, helping people who have been exposed to just stay home until we're sure that they're not going to get ill.
Sarah, thanks for calling. Best to you either way. I know there's a lot to worry about with your livelihood on the one hand and your health on the other. Back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi. If I understand it correctly, we're supposed to stay about 6 feet apart because the droplets from our breath or whatever would fall to the ground or sidewalk. And if that's the case, well, what if people are walking outside on a windy day like today? Would the wind keep the droplets with the virus airborne?
Dennis, thanks for the call, Dr. Remington. I know a lot of people are trying to model the, aerodynamics of this virus.
Well, there is some fake news on the internet about a study that wasn't actually a study. It was just an idea somebody had that these particles might stay airborne if you're running or bicycling. I think the most important thing is to use practical common sense, that 6 feet is a guideline. And that's about how far a sneeze or a cough, the droplets that come out from an ill person, would go. But if you're outside and the wind is blowing, you might be a little further. You might want to stay a little further apart. But then the other argument would be that it is outdoors and it's less likely, those viral particles are less likely to be suspended in air. So I think the idea is just don't gather closely. Certainly, things like shaking hands or being in a tight space with anybody outside of your family is not a good idea. And just use common sense if you're out of doors. But I encourage people to get out, to go for a walk. But if you're not within your nuclear family, people you're living with, keep your distance. 6 feet is a minimum. Why not be a little extra careful and stay a little further away?
Thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Remington, in our last minute and a half or so, you've mentioned the need for, in effect, an army of people to do contact tracing. Sounds like we need a lot more testing. Do you see us ramping up to have those things in place so that we can safely end things like safer at home orders?
Yes, I do. These are not impossible things. Obviously, we know we were woefully unprepared for this pandemic. We did not have the testing capacity in place. Our government state labs and the CDC lab just didn't have the capacity. We're ramping that up every minute of every day, and I think we're going to see more and more testing so that we not only test somebody who's critically ill to know their diagnosis, but we test people who have mild symptoms, even people who've been exposed, so that we can learn more about this disease and then do contact tracing. That's really smart contact tracing, not just what we've done, which is basically quarantine everybody because we don't have the capacity to do the kind of work that we need to do. And that's just finding the people. I know people are volunteering. There's a website. If you want to volunteer, you can do online work for the state health department, but they're going to need to get people to actually be boots on the ground, to walk from house to house, to talk to people, to find out what if someone is ill, who they've been in contact with, and make sure those contacts have been quarantined.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob, and stay safe.
You too. That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about public health efforts and COVID-19 and looking to the future. By the way, we've got a call from Aaron in Whitewater who mentioned that he just got out of donating blood himself. I understand there's a big demand for that. Aaron said there was a remote donation location, made him feel like he's making a difference. You can share your own story if you feel like you're doing something that made a difference or you're looking to do something. Email us ideas@wpr.org. As the coronavirus pandemic takes hold in Wisconsin, personal protective equipment is at a premium, and that's left some rural ambulance services in the state scrambling to keep up their supplies. Bram Sable-Smith reports.
Rob Pohl says the reality of the pandemic hit fast when the first positive case was confirmed in Bayfield County on March 19th.
And I think everybody up here was shocked because they thought we were rural and we moved, and then all of a sudden we had a positive person, and I think there's been two since.
Pulse is paramedic coordinator for Great Divide Ambulance in the town of Cable, population 850. He says his service staffs four ambulances 24 hours a day to cover around 730 square miles. That's four trucks to cover an area three times the size of Chicago. Pulse says he knew his crews were going to have to deal with the virus, but he wasn't expecting it so soon.
I don't want to say we were completely unprepared, but we're learning as we go.
They've had to adjust how they use personal protective equipment. His crews now wear a minimum of a face mask and gloves to every call. If a patient has COVID-19 symptoms, they don 95s, gowns, and face shields. It's a lot more equipment than they're used to using and procuring. Paul says it's been a wake-up call.
You called your regular suppliers and the phones wouldn't even answer. And some of them, they just kept ringing. Then now you call and you get a message saying, don't even ask us for for protective equipment, because we have none.
WPR and Wisconsin Watch spoke with members of six rural EMS services around the state, and while they all say they have enough protective equipment for the moment, sourcing those supplies right now is a challenge. Here's Ryan Olson of Chautauqua Ambulance Service.
We've tried every vendor that we use. We've searched the internet.
Jim Onstad of Iola Fire and Ambulance.
We reached out to automotive supply stores and purchase some N95s.
Aaron LeClaire of Door County Emergency Service.
We did do that early on. We went around to the local auto stores and bought up half-face respirators.
The state is distributing supplies from the Strategic National Stockpile and other sources. That's helped some rural services. But these same items are in demand all over, and the Department of Health Services has issued guidance on conserving supplies, saying it expects continued shortages. Mark Cohen of the Wisconsin EMS Association says there's another wrinkle to the increased use of protective gear, paying for it.
We're funded by spaghetti suppers and pancake breakfasts.
Unlike fire protection, say, there's no requirement for local governments to provide emergency medical services. Nearly 40% of Wisconsin's emergency medical workforce are volunteers. And in rural areas especially, ambulance services often rely on a patchwork of funding sources. Cohen says protective gear and other precautions makes responding to calls during this pandemic even more costly. So his association sent a letter to Governor Evers on April 3rd asking for a rate increase for emergency medical services. So far, no response.
The dollars that they get don't even come close to covering the cost of pulling the ambulance out of the station.
Back in Bayfield County, Rob Pohl says his service has put a lot of supplies on back order, much more than they need, because he's anticipating many orders won't get filled. Of course, it's also possible they will.
And that's a little dangerous for us financially because, you know, we have a pretty tight budget.
Still, he's hopeful the protective equipment supply chain will catch up eventually. And together, he says, we'll all get through this. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a state commerce group is asking Governor Evers to start planning for businesses to reopen. We'll hear their case and what they're hoping for. We'll check in on some of the biggest stories in national politics, including the latest on the rollout of economic recovery spending. And laughter may actually be pretty good medicine. A doctor tells us about laughter yoga, how it can boost our mental and physical health, and why even fake laughs can be good for us. You'll get to hear me doing some fake laughter and I think some real laughter too. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, the sports world has ground to a halt amid fears of the novel coronavirus. Kate and her guests look at the latest from the sports world and what to look forward to when things start to swing back into action. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, even thinking about swimming may help us beat cabin fever. We talked to an author about her new book on humans' attraction to getting into the water. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.